Well, everybody, welcome to Mech's Online Campus. I once heard of two nuns who worked as volunteer nurses in a hospital. This was many years ago. One morning, they ran out of gas while they were driving to work, and they saw a gas station nearby that they could walk to, but they realized they didn't have anything to put the gas in. Then one of them remembered that they had a bedpan in the trunk of the car. So they got the bedpan, they walked to the station, they filled it with gas, and they carefully carried it back to their car. And as the nuns were pouring the gas from the bedpan into their tank, two men in a truck drove by. And they looked at the nuns pouring the contents of the bedpan into the gas tank of the car, stared in complete disbelief, and then finally one said to the other, "Now, Fred, that's what I call faith." Now, have you ever had a bedpan moment? And I mean a real one. A time when you thought God was asking you to do something that was off the charts ridiculous, or believe something that was off the charts crazy, or trust in him for something that seemed certifiable to trust in him for. He was calling you to do something and follow him or towards something that made no sense, so much so that you could only just laugh at the thought of it. And did you ever think that maybe God was in on the joke? That he knew he was setting you up to have ridiculous levels of faith and trust in him, or he was asking you to have those levels and was having fun doing it. In fact, there may have been a part of it where he was just kind of goofing on you because it was fun and also faith building for you. Like, Noah, I want you to build a boat, but just for fun, let's do this one in the desert where there's absolutely no water and I'll tell you what goes in it later. Or if you're familiar with Joshua in the Bible, when he came to Jericho to take the city, and Joshua goes to God and said, "Okay, what's the plan? You know, forward assault? Are we going to sneak in at night? Is this going to be like a perimeter siege?" And God said, "I actually had a parade in mind. You know, lots of noise, trumpets, maybe some drums, some flags, some juggling. And let's do that parade every day for like 7 days. And that's the strategy." I mean, you can't make this stuff up. And there seems to be this pattern. God calls people to do something, but in answering that call, they have to demonstrate just sick levels of faith and trust and embrace what is comical. And sometimes they did laugh. They laughed in disbelief, you know, a laugh that said, "There's just no way. I mean, God, I love you and I want to follow you, but there's just no way that I can be discerning that this is your plan. It's just too crazy." We're in a series on When God Makes Us Laugh, and last week we looked at the humor of Jesus, kind of a walkthrough study of the ways and times that he used humor to make his point. Today, let's dig into the laugh of disbelief. And I want to do it by looking at the story of a man named Abram and his wife, Sarai. Let me read the start of their story. "The Lord said to Abram, 'Leave your native country, your relatives, your father's family, go to the land that I will show you. I will make you into a great nation. I will bless you and make you famous, and you'll be a blessing to others. I will bless those who bless you and curse those who treat you with contempt. All the families on the earth will be blessed through you.' So Abram departed as the Lord had instructed, and Lot, which was his brother, went with him. Abram was 75 years old when he left Haran. He took his wife Sarai, his nephew Lot, and all his wealth, his livestock, and all the people he had taken into his household at Haran, and headed for the land of Canaan." Now, if you're new to the unfolding story of the Bible, this that we just read is a pivotal section to take note of. The calling of Abram and the promise of a son and descendants is actually the beginning of the Jewish people. We just read the start of the entire Jewish race. As a called out group who would be used by God as a bridgehead onto the scene to call the world back to God. From Abram would come Isaac, and then Jacob, and then the 12 tribes of Israel, and then the exodus of the people of Israel from Egypt under Moses, and then entering the promised land, and all leading to the coming of the Messiah from the Jewish people who would be the key to the saving of the world. And that, of course, was Jesus. And like, you know, starting with an ocean and tracing an ocean to a major massive rivers, to a stream, to a creek, to a small spring, you can trace God's redemptive plan after we screwed it up so bad in the Garden of Eden back to this moment, from Jesus all the way back to Abram, the moment when God called Abram to start a people, a nation from whom a person would come, the God-man, God himself in human form, Jesus, to call the world back to God. But notice something important here. God waited to call Abram to this task of starting a nation when he was, wait for it, 75 years old. And not because he and Sarai hadn't tried that to have children. He was childless. They tried. So we're already seeing him calling a 75-year-old man, childless man, to start a nation. We can almost already see the twinkle in God's eye on this one. But to Abram's credit, he goes all in. Now, like most of us, when it comes to God and prayer and asking him things and needing things, we have only one timetable now. We have little place for waiting. We don't have room for weeks. We don't have room for months. Well, time went by for Abram and Sarai. A lot of time. We're not talking weeks. We're not talking months. We're talking years. And as strong as he had started out, he started to lose faith. And that's when God showed up and spoke to him again, this time in a vision. Sometime later, the Lord spoke to Abram in a vision and said to him, "Do not be afraid, Abram, for I will protect you and your reward will be great." Abram replied, "O sovereign Lord, what good are all your blessings when I don't even have a son? Since you've given me no children, Eleazar of Damascus, servant in my household, will inherit all my wealth. You've given me no descendants of my own, so one of my servants will be my heir." Then the Lord said to him, "No, your servant will not be your heir, for you will have a son of your own who will be your heir." Then the Lord took Abram outside and said to him, "Look up into the sky and count the stars if you can. That's how many descendants you will have." Abram believed the Lord, and the Lord counted him as righteous because of his faith. So, Abram keeps waiting. Now, the Bible keeps things pretty real, and this story is no exception. Some time went on after that vision, and Abram began to kind of just wonder whether this was all real or whether God was going to do this, or maybe there was a plan B that needed to be followed, and so he kind of ran out of that patience. Sarai certainly ran out of patience. By now, Abram was no longer 75. He was 85. So they came up with their own plan B. Here's what it was. Now, Sarai, Abram's wife, had not been able to bear children for him, but she had an Egyptian servant named Hagar. So Sarai said to Abram, "The Lord has prevented me from having children. Go and sleep with my servant. Perhaps I can have children through her." And Abram agreed with Sarai's proposal. So Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar, the Egyptian servant, and gave her to Abram as a wife. This happened 10 years after Abram had settled in the land of Canaan. Now, a little background here. In the ancient Near Eastern culture of that day, there was little knowledge of what we would call gynecology. When it came to children, what was believed was that the man was everything. There was no understanding that conception was the result of a male sperm and a female egg. Instead, the man just deposited his seed, and the woman was simply the incubator of that. What mattered was the man's semen. There was also no knowledge of modern-day genetics, so there was no sense that a different woman other than your wife would have any bearing whatsoever on the child. So if a wife couldn't bear children, it wasn't unheard of at all for the husband to bear children through a servant or a concubine of some kind. It wasn't plan A, but it wasn't necessarily a scandal either. In fact, in that day, it was often the wife's responsibility to make sure that there was a surrogate child bearer if needed. But for Abram and Sarai, as we already know, this was bigger than that. God had told them he was going to give them a child through Sarai. He told them that his call in their life was to create an entire nation through them. And here, Sarai said, it was God who made her barren. Something had happened to whatever God had promised. So she was now having to take things into her own hands and make sure that Abram had a child. And Abram went along with it. And most of the men listening to me would think, well, I'll bet he did. It worked. Hagar got pregnant and gave birth to a son that was named Ishmael when Abram was 86 years old. Okay, now fast forward for the next scene. 13 years later, God shows up again to remind Abram of his promise. Let me read it. When Abram was 99 years old, the Lord appeared to him and said, "I am El Shaddai, God Almighty. Serve me faithfully and live a blameless life. I will make a covenant with you by which I will guarantee to give you countless descendants." At this, Abram fell face down on the ground, and then God said to him, "This is my covenant with you. I will make you the father of a multitude of nations. What's more, I am changing your name. It will no longer be Abram. Instead, you will be called Abraham. And by the way, Abram is the father of one, and Abraham is a word for the father of many. For you will be the father of many nations. I will make you extremely fruitful. Your descendants will become many nations. So Abram, now Abraham, which means, as I said, the father of many, is now 99 years old. This is the third time God has come to him, starting back when he was a young nipper of 75, to say, we're in a covenant together. I made you a promise. This is happening. Now, Abraham probably by now isn't too worried about the baby side of it. Hagar took care of that. Ishmael by now is around 13. He's just wondering how the rest of it is going to unfold, because one son isn't exactly the start of countless descendants, but God wasn't finished. At 99, the time had come finally for the big reveal. And here it is. God also said to Abraham, as for Sarai, your wife, you are no longer to call her Sarai. Her name will be Sarah. I will bless her and will surely give you a son by her. I will bless her so that she will be the mother of nations. Kings of peoples will come from her. Now, here we see that Sarai gets a name change too. She went from Sarai, spelled with an I, to Sarah, spelled with an H. You know, we've dug into this in terms of Hebrew etymology, and it's really unclear what the old spelling indicated, but the new spelling, we do know, meant princess, indicating she was going to share in Abraham's calling and that kings would descend from her. And this is important. It made it clear that the entire covenant would be jointly fulfilled through her. She was going to have a son. At 90 years of age, long past her childbearing years and physical ability to get pregnant, she would get pregnant, have a child, and that child would be the fulfillment of this calling that God had put before Abraham 25 years before. Now, look at what that made the pre-Viagra Abraham do in light of his post-menopausal wife. Then Abraham bowed down to the ground, but he laughed to himself in disbelief. How could I become a father at the age of 100, he thought. And how can Sarah have a baby when she is 90 years old? So Abraham said to God, may Ishmael, you know, live under your special blessing. But God replied, no, Sarah, your wife, will give birth to a son for you. You will name him Isaac. And I will confirm my covenant with him and his descendants as an everlasting covenant. My covenant will be confirmed with Isaac, who will be born to you and Sarah about this time next year. When God had finished speaking, he left Abraham. Now, let me sharpen that up a little bit, because I think it's important. Abraham didn't laugh at God, mocking him. He laughed with God, you know, about God, about what God was saying. He was laughing at the very idea of it all, the absurdity, the incredible craziness of it all. Have you ever done that? If you haven't, if you keep walking with God, you will, particularly if you listen to him. God seems to set us up for it, like I said earlier, with a twinkle in his eye. When Moses went up to part the ocean, don't you think he just had to be kind of laughing about it inside? You know, when he held it up, saying, okay, I'm actually holding up this rod for the ocean to part, you know, because God told me to. And Orban David, you know, picked up that rock for a slingshot to take on Goliath, how he must have had just a smile on his face at the craziness of what God was going to do through a shepherd boy to the greatest warrior on the planet. Can't you just hear the laugh of a young girl named Mary who was told she was going to have a baby even though she knew she was a virgin? And was God upset at the laugh? No. He'd been waiting for it. In fact, you want to know something? Remember how God told Abraham to name the son from Sarah Isaac? Do you know what the name Isaac means? Isaac means he laughs. Well, the fun wasn't over. We haven't gotten to where Sarah hears about all this. Let me read that. Sarah was listening at the tent opening. Abraham and Sarah were old by this time, very old. Sarah was far past the age for having babies. Sarah laughed within herself. An old woman like me get pregnant with this old man of a husband? God said to Abraham, why did Sarah laugh, saying, me, have a baby, an old woman like me? Is anything too hard for God? I'll be back about this time next year. Sarah will have a baby. Sarah lied. She said, I didn't laugh, because she was afraid. And God said, yes, you did. You laughed. It cracks me up every time I read it. I mean, Sarah's eavesdropping on this whole thing and laughs just like Abraham did. But she gets caught a little bit, and she gets this little gentle kind of admonition from God about how he most certainly can pull off anything and everything he wants, and reminds her that, yes, about a year from now, there will be a son. But what I find funny is when she says, oh, I didn't laugh, and God says, oh, yes, you did. Oh, no, I didn't. Yeah, you did. Back and forth. And it's like, again, God's just kind of having fun with it. Well, there's one last laugh in this story, and I think it's a kind of sweet one. Let me read it. Now, the Lord is gracious to Sarah, as he had said, and the Lord did for Sarah what he had promised. Sarah became pregnant and bore a son to Abraham in his old age, at the very time God had promised him. Abraham gave the name Isaac to the son Sarah bore him, and Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born to him. Sarah said, and this is her looking back on it, God has brought me laughter, and everyone who hears about this will laugh with me. And she added, who would have said to Abraham that Sarah would nurse children? Yet I have borne him a son in his old age. I love that whole story. Abraham and Sarah learned how to laugh with God, first at the outrageous promises and claims and activities and leadings, a laugh of a mouth wide open with disbelief, or at least wide open at the faith it would take to follow it. Because these laughs really are about a 100% faith ride. And I think it's a wonderful laugh. It's a healthy laugh. It's a faith-building laugh, because it's not the laugh of mockery, but it's a laugh at the crazy adventure of it all. The laugh of a roller coaster ride, the laugh of whitewater rapids, the laugh of a bungee jump, the laugh that comes when you do something you can hardly believe anyone in their right mind would do, but God in his right mind is calling you to do it, to believe it, to live in light of it. And you never felt more alive. Those are life-changing laughs. Have you laughed like that in recent years? You say, well, God hasn't exactly paid me any visits, laying any big faith steps on me, or things to believe or things to act on. Hasn't he? If you were to think about it. Isn't there one thing you've read in the Bible, or heard maybe during one of our times together, or felt impressed on your spirit by God to do that was faith challenging? Maybe to give an irrationally generous gift, maybe to serve selflessly where it really was a sacrificial cost for you to do so, to reach out courageously and take a relational risk and share what Jesus could mean to a friend, to wait expectantly on something that you truly do believe that God has told you he's going to do, to step out risk-takingly. Can't you take the bait, laugh the laugh God is laughing as well, and join the faith adventure he's calling all of us to live? Do you know that we're having this time right now, we're here together because of one of those laughs? In fact, a whole series over the years of laughs just like this, but I'll tell you about just one of them that kind of came to my mind as I was thinking about this. As some of you know, my wife Susan and I started this church from scratch. No people, no money, no building, no nothing. Came down here in a U-Haul. We had our first meeting, and our first several months of meetings was in a ballroom at a Hilton hotel, because there was nowhere else to meet at that time. We worked as hard as we knew to get as many people to get to our first service as possible, and 112 showed up. Through the strength of my preaching, we were at 56 by the third week. Cut that sucker right in half. It was a hard first year, particularly with money. And the biggest expense that we had that was a continual burden and hardship to get was just a place to meet, just to have, you know, to worship together and to meet and to have services. There came a time, I remember, when I could not pay what we owed. The money that I had raised on the front end had kind of gone down, was done. The money that had started to come in through those faithful first attenders was far shy of what we needed. And so we reached a point where the hotel people said, you're going to have the money owed us by next Sunday. You got to come with that check. We're going to give you a week, but you got to come with that check, or else we can't even let you meet next Sunday. So you got to come with it. and it was $5,000. I didn't know what I was going to do. I prayed and I prayed. Susan and I had already given everything we had and sold everything that we had that we could sell. I tried to auction off one of our kids. That didn't work. I did everything I knew to do to come up with that money, and it just didn't come. When you lead a church, I'll let you in on something, you have this secret fantasy that someone's going to miraculously put this huge million-dollar check in your offering plate or make a million-dollar online donation. It's never happened to me. It still hasn't ever happened to me. So some of you now know how to make my fantasy come true. But the time came for me to pay up. It was a Sunday morning, and if I didn't hand over a check for $5,000, we wouldn't be able to meet. But it was more than not being able to meet. People would come. Here was this fledgling church. Nobody had any roots with it or anything, and we were just building it family by family, and we were a real unknown factor as a brand new church. And they would come that Sunday and find us locked out with nowhere to go, which would certainly put a lot of confidence in them for us, wouldn't it? And the fledgling church I had started would just die. We didn't have the money in the bank, though, to write the check. So, I mean, what was I going to do? You know, I didn't have the money, but I just knew it wasn't God's will that the church just die and you know, just close. So suddenly I knew what I was supposed to do. It just kind of hit me what I had to do, what God was telling me to do. Write that check out for $5,000, hand it over that Sunday morning, and let God take care of it. And that is what I did. I don't recommend this as a strategy for your next mortgage payment, but this is what God called me. Unmistakably, I was to do it. I couldn't help but almost laugh at the absurdity of it all. Either God's going to come through or I'm going to jail. It's going to be one of the two. But I knew it wasn't God's will for the church to fold. I just knew that to the core of my being. And I also knew that I would also be handing over a check, though, that if God didn't come through, it was going to bounce. So I wrote the check. And I remember my hand was shaking a little bit when I handed it over to him. And check in hand, they said, okay, fine, thank you. We went ahead with the services that day. And then when it was over, no, there was not a $1 million check in that week's offering. In fact, it was a particularly low offering. So I went home and I got into a fetal position and just began to pray. But I had to get out of the fetal position a few hours later because I had a meeting that night with some little church's missions committee, a meeting I almost canceled because I was in, you know, obviously a mental and emotional kind of wreck. But I went through with this meeting anyway. It was just a little church, like dozens of others, little churches that I would talk about, you know, cast a vision to maybe financially support this new church start in Charlotte, that Mecklenburg Community Church that was trying to reach people who were desperately far from God. And by the way, let me tell you how these things work. Once you meet with these committees, it's months before anything results because they would have to, so I wasn't looking to them for the answer for the immediate need. They have to think about it. They have to pray about it. They often have to schedule a church-wide vote for it or whatever. So I was really plowing up ground for months in the future, but I had no passion for doing it that night because I didn't know if we were going to have a future. Anyway, I went, did my spiel, thought it went okay, not great, but okay. I came home and began my ulcer over what I had done earlier in that day with that $5,000 check. Monday morning, the next day, I decided on a lark, just because I had nothing else to do and I was trying to distract myself, I decided I just would call the pastor of the church, do a little follow-up that I talked to the night before. So I thanked him for letting me come and speak, and I said, well, how did you think it went? And he said, great. You know, as a matter of fact, he said, I'm a little surprised. They already decided to give you $10,000 and $5,000 of it right away. So when do you need it? I said, by 2. I'm coming over right now. And again, I just couldn't help but laugh almost the whole way over. And I think God did too. It was a good laugh, like Sarah laughing on the front end with the craziness of it all and then laughing sweetly at it on the back end, reflecting on God's amazing faithfulness. There's an important lesson here that I would hate for us to miss, and that is that this kind of laughter really is part of our relationship with God. It's part of the play in life, God playing with us, us going along for the ride, but it's a faith-building enterprise. G.K. Chesterton once wrote that God may be the only true child left in the universe, while all the rest of us have lost our capacity for real joy and wonder. He even goes so far as to suggest that much of God's creative activity was actually play. Let me see if I can give you the gist of his thinking on this. One of the games I used to play with my kids when they were young was called Tickle Slide. And I had built this little swing set in our backyard, and they would climb to the top of the slide part of it, and I would straddle the slide at the bottom and waiting for them to come down. And as they came down the slide, I would tickle them the whole way down. And then they'd get down to the bottom and say, do it again, and do it again. So they'd climb back up, do it, and I'd do it again, tickle them over and over again. If I did it 20 times, they'd say, do it again that 21st time. So how did God create daisies? Did he just say, daisies be? Or Chesterton says we might want to think about it a little bit differently. That after he created the first little daisy, something childlike inside the very heart of God yelled, do it again. So God created daisy number two. And then something inside of God said, do it again. And daisy number three was created. And then four, and then five, and then six, and then 50 billion trillion daisies later, the great God of the universe is still jumping up and down, clapping his hands and having a blast. Listen to how Chesterton describes it. He says, it is possible that God says every morning, do it again to the sun, and every evening, do it again to the moon. It may not be automatic necessity that makes all daisies alike. It may be that God makes every daisy separately, but has never got tired of making them. It may be that he has the eternal appetite of infancy. For we have sinned and grown old, and our Father is younger than we. So learn to laugh with God, even in disbelief, but anchor that disbelief with faith that calls you to trust and action. You'll shake your head on the front end with, you know, but you'll also laugh at the end as well when you see just how faithful God is. Well, let me pray for you. Father, I do pray that whatever adventure you have in store for you would be not only made known, but that they would see the joy of following you in it. That once there's a clear sense of your pull, your leadership, your will, no matter how crazy, insane, comical it may seem, I pray that they would go on the adventure of faith and let that faith be grown and expanded in ways that only this kind of laughter can bring. And I pray that in the name of Jesus. Amen.